1996, we're in Walter Jacobs' office, Rabbi Walter Jacobs' office. Gabi Denman and I, in taking our notes and debriefing, recently found out that tape 5, side 9, the audio was almost completely lost. We have the notes, so we've decided that based on the notes that we took, we will re-interview Dr. Walter Jacob as accurately as we can according to those that hour. So here we go, Walter. We started out where Gabi had asked you about your brother who was a professor at Northwestern University, and you told us a great deal about what he did, and also the I'm asking a little more because I know a little more what you answered, that your brother and you sort of balanced out your father's career, one a professor and one a rabbi.
Okay. The first thing I have to say, as this is a second take on this tape, is that you will discover here that history changes. If somebody's able to listen to the earlier version, they may find it a little different than the later version. But that's okay.
Would you tell about it then?
But let's talk a little bit about Herbert, who just died.
What date?
On the 29th of August. It was interesting and good to hear his colleagues, two of his colleagues, speak about him. And there was also a very nice long obituary in the Chicago Tribune about him and what he had done. As far as our separate and combined paths, my father, as you know, was both rabbi in Springfield, Missouri, and a professor at Drury College. So we more or less divided his career. He became a professor, and I became a rabbi. But we also trespassed on each other's territory. So he was quite active in the Jewish community and also in a good many general causes. I did some serious studies, particularly in the field which was essentially his field, law. So there was a fair amount of vagueness there in that respect. One of the people who spoke, not at the funeral, but afterwards at the Shiva, we had informal comments from various people who were there. And one of them, my cousin, Avi Lowenthal, who had come from Israel for the funeral, mentioned that he had looked him up in the Hebrew University library or the Technion University, I'm not sure which, and had found that people had, when they had looked at Herbert Jacobs' books, had nothing but nice things to say about them. However, when he looked to see what Herbert Jacob had to say about other people, he found him extremely critical. And he was. He had a very good, logical mind developed it in a critical fashion. From age, we were together a great deal growing up because we shared rooms, I guess, for the first 17 years of his life, 20 years of my life, not quite. The first 3 years I was alone, I wasn't born yet. So in those years, really did almost everything or a great deal together, as much as you could with the age difference. In Missouri, that meant taking a lot of hikes together. Very early, he, in about seventh or eighth grade, he became a debater and on a debate team. And that developed his logical, critical approach to matters. When he was ready to go to college, He applied and received a scholarship to Harvard, and both of us left at the same time. He went to Harvard and I went to Hebrew Union College. And I visited him there at Harvard a number of times and found that in those days you needed no credentials to wander around the campus. And there were always enough people who didn't go to class that there were plenty of empty seats. So I went to class with him and soon saw that you could have gotten a complete Harvard education for absolutely nothing. No diploma at the end, but you could have done everything else. He then, after that, we both shared our military experience time. He was in the Army and had a nice assignment at the Presidio in San Francisco, and I saw him both before my going out to the Pacific and afterwards. He was ended up being a clerk, that's a fairly well-educated clerk, with I think the rating of a corporal, and we kidded about that. The after that he got married and then went to Yale for graduate studies. And in that period, and I visited him there, Irene and I visited him there too, a little later. But in that period, he did a thesis in Germany on German administration, which ended as a book, Administration Since Bismarck. So he was in Europe when Irene and I got married and represented the family at the wedding. I think I've mentioned to you that at this wedding where no one knew me except a couple of family members, and we looked enough alike that he received half the congratulations. And I guess I should have given him half the presents, but never did that. When he came back, he got his doctorate from Yale, he went to Tulane, where we visited, of course, and Madison, University of Wisconsin.
And what did he do in Tulane?
He was a professor of political science, and developed a specialty there in state government, wrote some good texts. And then he went to the University of Wisconsin, and then Northwestern University. And we always had a custom of visiting back and forth. Now, all of these places are fairly distant. I remember driving to Tulane with just one child at that time, Poopsie, and on the way back we ran into a terrible snowstorm. The roads were in awful shape. They had, in fact, closed the highway in Alabama, but let our car through because we were northerners and had snow tires. But the other trips were always at Thanksgiving time. And, you know, from here to Madison, Wisconsin is about a 10-11-hour drive, which with little kids you can only do through the night. Chicago is about 8 hours. And Thanksgiving time means that somewhere along the line you're going to hit a snowstorm.
And how long was he in New Orleans then?
Not very long, maybe 3 years. And then perhaps another 3 years at Wisconsin, and then almost 30 years at Northwestern. He proceeded then to develop a specialty in law and political science, and wrote a lot on the actual workings of the law. I mean, that was his investigation. So he looked into not what is the law of bankruptcy, but what actually happens when somebody is bankrupt. He had a very good book on plea bargaining. Now, how does this really work? Not as what's the theory of it, but what happens? And his latest study, which was just published, and which was going to lead into a much more detailed study, was what happens to both the appointment of judges or election of judges. You know, what kind of people are we really getting? And then how do the judicial apportionments, once somebody is appointed, how does that really work? So, for example, I talked to him in, I guess, last spring during a visit, and he told me that if you are elected in Cook County, which is probably the largest county in the United States, or the most densely populated, as a judge, you will be appointed to the traffic court first. How long you remain in the traffic court depends on how good your political connections are. You may be there for 3 months, you may be there for 2 years. So, you know, those are not the kind of things that appear in the legislation that deals with courts.
And the assumption usually is the magistrate that is the
well, other. But in this case, it's in Chicago, it's different.
Okay.
So this is the book which just appeared. It deals with these matters internationally. So you've got 10 or 8 scholars, I've forgotten how many, that treat this in Japan, Germany, England, a few other countries. A more detailed study, he was getting that underway, but he only got, I think, 2 chapters of that done. But all of these were efforts, in a sense, to quietly provide the background for proper change. I did that also with divorce laws. You know, what is the law? How does it really work? How does it function? And what effect does that have on people? And then he was always interested in social justice causes. So, for example, apartheid, dealt with that rather vigorously, women's issues, and rather frustrated by the Gingrich Republicans, did what he could. One of the minor things that he did, and I thought that was a cute idea, he created a series of labels which he put on letters, hoping that not only the recipient but maybe even the postal worker or the postal clerk would see these things. Something like, you know, how would you like to live without health insurance? Or pointed questions.
Walter, for the sake of the oral history, since Mr. Gingrich is a relatively new person in our political scene, could you just, for the oral history, just explain the Speaker of the House, etc.?
He is a short-term Speaker of the House of Representatives, representing the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, and with an effort to pass lots of legislation which rescinds previous social legislation. Now, we in our we were always in contact once a week, either by letter or by telephone, and then saw each other as often as possible, and watched each other's children. He has 4 children, grow up, and never really worked together on any project officially, but often talked about what each of us was doing, and you know, criticized. He was more critical than I guess I was, that being our nature, and saw a good bit of each other through the years.
How old were his children? Are his children?
His children they range from 36 to 22.
Anything you'd like to tell us about the children? Or?
They each have their own career. One of them is a musician and a composer. That's Joel, the oldest child. The next one, David, is a social worker and quite idealistic. The third, Jenny, is also a social worker of a slightly different kind, a more mediator like her mother, his wife, Lynn, is a family mediator. And the youngest, Max, is a he's beginning to work for one of the big accounting firms. He's not an accountant, but he's more into personnel and so on.
So his wife, Lynn, is an attorney, or?
No, she's a family mediator. It's a sort of a social work field. And there they shared a real interest in that, and family and family law. He was about to receive, there's an association of political science, I've forgotten the real name of it, political scientists who deal with the field of law, which is really something that he was instrumental in establishing. And they were about to honor him at their national convention, which meant that a lot of his friends, who normally would have been at the funeral, were out in San Diego. And I guess the other thing one should say, he was also very much at the forefront of doing things with computers. For 10 years, he has run a a magazine that appears primarily on the computer, a book review magazine, which has a fair number of subscribers, several thousand subscribers, and was in the process of establishing a second. And on these things, he certainly could advise me, because he was much more into that, and also, frankly, had more time, much more free time for this sort of thing than I have. So he, with his hobby of photography, he used the computer to generate enlargements, which I will also do eventually, but it is at this point very time consuming, and I just haven't had the time to do that. So we shared skiing together, photography, hiking, an interest in law, Judaism, aside from, you know, family connections.
And memory.
Sure.
Question?
Certainly.
Now, did he do the computer magazine along with his work at Northwestern, or had he already retired?
Oh, no, he hadn't retired. He was younger than I. He was 63 when he died. No, this was part of his work at Northwestern. And he was also always very good at getting support from either the National Endowment for the Humanities or one of the other organizations, and held some positions there, as well as the presidency of various political science groups. For a while, chaired the department at Northwestern. Those things are, however, really a bit of a nuisance too, because you end up doing more administrative work than other. And there he was probably that led him and the two of us once to a long, long discussion where both of us had varying thoughts. What do you do with minorities at graduate school level? Admission is no problem. If they are not up to par, but you feel that they are mentally okay and capable, you can admit them and work with them to see to it that they catch up. But what if after some years they simply are not going to make it? And their thesis work is subpar, or for that matter, you hired somebody and they're not producing. So that ends up being difficult. But in the final analysis, both of us agree that you cannot make any exceptions there, because you cannot have a doctorate that is one kind of doctorate for somebody who is Afro-American and another kind of doctorate for somebody who is not.
Well, exactly. The assumption is not that just only African-Americans do substandard work, but that others do too, and you want them treated equally.
Well, but the reality was that those were the candidates we were talking about.
So what are you saying then, that in Do you feel that you were giving them sort of a start by admitting them and then seeing how they progressed?
Well, I wasn't, but I mean...
They have to be in
there. Well, no,
they have to be in a club?
No.
No, they don't have to be admitted.
No.
Not to graduate school. Mm-hmm.
They have to have an average.
So if you're not, you know, you don't have to admit people.
You don't have a B average in graduate school.
Who don't, you know, don't make, but you can lean over backwards there.
In the admissions, I've talked to professors where admissions were then how whether they could sustain them, and then I think the consensus is you can't produce substandard people. So is this part of his book?
No. This was just part of a private discussion
that you two had.
That we had a couple of times. And he was, you know, stuck to his guns when it came to not making exceptions for people who were simply not able to do the work or who found clever excuses. One of the professors at the Shiva also indicated that a student had sent in a paper on email and the paper was late, and claimed that there was a computer foul up, the paper was really on time. So my brother said, well, all right, bring in your computer. So the kid brought in the computer, and so he turned it on, and of course the computer dates when sometimes.
Absolutely.
And I guess you could fudge that, but this student hadn't thought of doing that. And so this showed very clearly that the paper was indeed not turned in on time.
The computer
used to say the dog ate the homework. The dog ate the homework.
Walter, one of the questions that Gabby asked you last week that you covered very extensively, and it was very interesting, is how the junior congregation started, when it started, you said 1935, and then the whole reason that the need in the congregation to have a junior congregation and its autonomy. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could, I'm sorry to guess.
No, that's all right. Clearly, when Dr. Freehoff came, that was 34, so he had settled in a little bit. His assistant at the time, who I don't remember who that was, Kagan, I think, or Rothschild, one of the two, doesn't matter.
Rothschild was here in the year 1939.
Yeah, so it was probably, that we can look up.
Okay.
I think it was Kagan. Decided that something else was necessary for a couple of reasons. One is that young people needed to express leadership ability at an earlier age than the system of brotherhood, sisterhood, and senior board permitted. Secondly, they needed a way of joining a congregation without making a large financial commitment. And third, they needed to be able to program on their own in ways that were totally independent, possibly even making mistakes, but be permitted to make them. And so the junior congregation was created as a separate entity within the larger congregation, which permitted all of these things. It has always been totally independent as far as programming goes, sets its own dues at whatever level is considered appropriate, gives the senior congregation whatever it considers appropriate. However, every member of the junior congregation is a member of the senior congregation too, so that you have all the rights and privileges of membership in the congregation without certainly the financial obligation. It also provided right away a membership for the president on the Board of Trustees, which in those early days, because the Board of Trustees was in essence non-rotating till I be- until about the time I became rabbi, which is 30 years after that, my guess is that that person, for all those years, for most of those 30 years, felt very much like a grandchild sitting at the table of his seniors, because these people were not only much older, but they had usually served on the board for many, many years. There were some people who I know served on the board for 50 years. So that also governed the nature of the meetings, because everybody had a pretty good idea after, long before 50 years had elapsed, what anybody's feeling was on virtually any matter. So I suppose there were many instances where there was really no debate, but just an exchange of looks, that was enough to settle the issue. The junior congregation very quickly, that's speculation, that's not history, the junior congregation very quickly gained popularity and a sizable membership, which then increased very rapidly after the Second World War, because you had a large number of people who had not been able to do anything for 4 or 5 years if they were in the military, and now wanted to join an organization, a synagogue, found this an ideal medium.
Okay, Walter, what I wanted to ask you, you mentioned today, not on the last tape that went amok, you did mention approximately how much it cost for a junior congregant. It was approximately $25, but you alluded today, unless I misunderstood you, they decided what they would give to the senior congregation. So did they give some money to
them? Oh, yes, they always did. And in most instances, it was 50% of whatever sum they collected. Now, 25, it was usually graduated, so that if you, by age, so that let's say up to age 25, it was, I'm making these figures up, $25. Then by 28, it was $50. And by 30 or 32, it was $100. Then slowly it got closer to the dues of senior congregation, or at least somewhere in that range. And then somewhere along the line, you were passed on to the senior congregation. The leadership, some of the leadership of the senior congregation has come from the junior congregation. So Bart Cowan, previously Al Raisman, and Marvin Joseph, who were presidents, or Bart is a president of the senior congregation now, were presidents of the junior congregation. Hasn't happened automatically to everybody, but to some individuals. The programming, especially during the years of civil rights or other issues that rose, in which certainly the older generation did not see eye to eye with the younger generation, they programmed what they wanted to. So we, in those years, had some very radical people who spoke under our banner, so to speak, and sometimes the senior congregation was not happy.
Any names coming
in? Names are not right offhand, I'd have to look. But they were simply told this is their prerogative. And if you want to have somebody speaking under that. And that also, frankly, turned out to be very useful when I became a rabbi, because you could look for sponsorship under somebody who was more likely to say yes than some official committee of the senior congregation, and it would float. So, for example, it's in that way that we adopted, I guess in about 66 or so, Mother's Day Out, which is still here. People were not too anxious to have lots of children running around the building, some of whom were Jewish, and many were not Jewish. But as junior congregation, at my suggestion, said they wanted this, all right, there wasn't much choice about doing it. The other, I ought to mention one funny thing, too. when I came, they had a series of programs called Ask the Rabbi. Now, remember, I was brand new, straight from the Hebrew Union College, and I wasn't ordained yet. And Marvin Joseph and his wife invited me for dinner. That was fine. Then afterwards, all of these people appeared. I had no idea this was coming. And all of a sudden, I was seated, so to speak, against the fireplace, and they started to ask me questions.
Was the fire lit?
It was funny.
Do you remember some of the questions, Walter?
Oh, no, I don't remember. They weren't all that difficult, but there were obviously going to be some questions about congregational policy. I think I'd been here all of 2 weeks. I had no idea what congregational policy was.
Walter, of the dues, the number of members that we have here at Temple, the Shulton Temple, what percentage need some kind of assistance where they don't pay their dues or don't pay full dues? Is that an issue?